This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
One of the surprising facts about 2018 is the way the year started and the way it ended. Stocks, which were setting new records, ended up the year with losses. Oil prices, which hit multi-year highs, fell nearly 40% by year end. At this time, stock prices are rising again, and oil prices have regained some of the losses of last year. Still, there's a degree of pessimism when it comes to oil. Investment banks have lowered their price forecast for oil this year, and that reflects a growing pessimism that the demand for oil is peaking. In fact, Bank of America just issued a report that oil demand growth will hit zero by the end of the next decade as a result of electric cars, something we've been talking about on this show. So it's not surprising that investments in oil and energy have languished over the last 12 months. Well, we disagree with those views, and we believe that oil prices are heading higher. In fact, much higher than Wall Street believes. And in fact, Jim, you were a bull on energy. If I'm recalling, you were a bull all of last year on energy, and the swift correction we saw last year that took oil prices down by 40% is something that you view as more of a correction than the beginning of a new bear market in oil. And you still believe that oil prices are heading higher, and you think oil and energy investments are undervalued, unloved by investors, and are underowned. So explain.
Well, as we covered in our show, What the Hell Just Happened, when we saw oil prices drop precipitously by that 40%, reaching a low on December 24th, we did a show and we explained the steep sell-off at year-end was caused by three factors. And let me just quickly go through them. Trump granting waivers to buyers of Iranian oil, increased production by OPEC ahead of those sanctions, and U.S. shale. And then also slowing economic growth. Now, those three factors might have been a cause for the decline when we saw Brent hit 87 and we saw WTI hit 77. But the steepness of the decline, as well as its accelerated recovery, had a lot more to do with algo trading than anything else. How else could you logically explain a 40% decline and then a 30% rise, all taking place in a matter of just 2 months? So I want to get into some of the fundamental facts here that you don't hear much from what I call financial media. As a result of the impending sanctions, let's go back to when this started. And that went back to last May. So Trump pulls out of the Iranian deal. He tells, basically, we're going to slap sanctions on. And basically, Trump is urging OPEC, hey, start increasing because a lot of oil is going to come off the market. So between April and November of last year, OPEC production increased by 1.1 million barrels a day. Now, the result was that OPEC added 200 million barrels of extra supply. But here's the interesting fact. Global inventories increased by only 25 million barrels. 200 million extra barrels added, but only 25 million made their way into inventory. So the surplus in inventories is a lot less than the increased production that came online, and those excess inventories are mainly a U.S. issue, also contributing to the buildup in inventories here in the U.S., and this gets once again to politics, is the trade war between the U.S. and China, because China stopped buying about 500,000 barrels of oil from the U.S. So as a result of waivers being given, OPEC quickly responded, by the way, in December. They don't wait around for a couple months. Should we cut? Should we not cut? Because the president was tweeting, hey, don't cut. Well, guess what? A month later, they cut production by 1.2 million barrels. And the reason why inventories are not as high as believed is global demand is consistently being understated. Actual demand for oil has been much greater than estimates. And here is something that we see repeated almost year after year. The fact that it gets little attention is the IEA, which most analysts base their energy demand projections on, has revised its demand projections higher in 7 out of the last years by 1.2 million barrels on average. So while analysts talk about peak demand, the IEA has consistently been revising demand upwards. And this misperception, Chris, has gone unrecognized in the oil markets, and it still persists today.
But Jim, what about U.S. shale production? It's expected that shale production is going to further increase this year. Isn't that a factor in the bearishness of oil?
Well, I'm glad you brought up, because if you look at non-OPEC production outside the U.S., it has deteriorated sharply over the last 6 months of 2018. Nobody's talking about that. There's been a dearth of conventional oil discoveries over the past decade. And according to the IEA, discoveries have been added roughly about 110 million billion barrels, that is, versus consumption of 360 billion barrels. So we're only discovering about a third of what we're consuming. So if you take outside of Russia and the U.S., non-OPEC production declined by a million barrels per day between July and December, with a steep drop-off in the North Sea, in Mexico and Brazil, not to mention drop-offs within OPEC, including Nigeria, Venezuela, and Libya. In fact, instead of a drop-off in demand, an increase in supply, the biggest risk to global oil markets the next decade, and nobody's talking about this other than the IEA, is not an oversupply, as a lot of these Wall Street analysts have been coming out with reports, but rather a shortfall in supply overlaid on an increasing rather than decreasing demand. Now, this view has been repeatedly stated by Dr. Faith Beryl, executive director of the IEA. Chris, let's play that clip from a Bloomberg interview that he did last November on this very subject.
How do you see the price in oil falling affecting demand worldwide?
I think the oil prices came from $86 only a few weeks ago to around $70 today. I would say from a global economy point of view, this is a good news. It provided comfort to the markets, especially consumers around the world. And I hope that this situation, this comfortable situation, continues for some time to come, especially at a time when the global economic growth prospects are getting less and less optimistic. But when we look at a few years ahead from now, we see serious challenges coming in terms of oil markets. The demand, global oil demand, still grows significantly, but the supply, where will the supply come from, is a key question. When we look at the investment appetite today across the world for the conventional oil in Middle East, in Russia, Latin America, Africa, and elsewhere, to be honest with you, the investment appetite is very, very weak, and we cannot expect U.S. shale alone to fill the gap between the demand and weak conventional projects. U.S. shale does an excellent job, but we can't expect everything from the shale.
Fatih Birol, if there is a supply cut of 1 million barrels a day in oil, what would that do to demand, what would it do to supply, and what would it actually do to the prices?
I think if the U.S., if the investment appetite remains so weak, which is about the current investment flows are one-third of the historical averages, very low, except for U.S. shale. And U.S. shale, in order to avoid a supply crunch, needs to increase in the next 7 years more than 10 million barrels per day, which means U.S. shale needs to add one Russia, even more than that. So this is a tall order, and this, if it doesn't happen, this would push the prices up, which is, again, not a good news for anybody, for the consumers today, but also for the producers tomorrow. So therefore, the message is clear. In addition to the big growth coming from U.S. shale, we need the oil production growth coming from the conventional, from Middle East, Russia, Africa, and elsewhere. Therefore, investment, investment, and investment, very important today.
You've also commented about this along with several of your experts on the program, Jim. Yet this view that we're awash in oil still persists. Why do you believe that to be the case?
You know, I think, Chris, you have to take a look at what has transpired in the oil markets, especially given where oil prices went in the last decade when we saw oil prices peak in the summer of 2008, where they got up to $150 a barrel. And then they pretty much, even after the financial crisis, they did come down during the crisis, but they went right back up over 100. So the steep decline that we saw in oil from over, let's say, $100 a barrel down to $26 a barrel in 2016. You combine that with the increase that we're seeing in U.S. shale production. I would have never thought that, going back in the last decade, you'd ever see the U.S. once again regain its position as the world's leading oil producer. And so that has given sway to the view that we are always around the corner from the next oil glut. Then there's the view that, for example, and we've got several reports we'll talk about, that electric vehicles will dramatically reduce demand for oil, so we are more likely to live in a world of oil surpluses rather than oil demand shocks, which I think we will face in the next decade. I mean, if we go back to the oil glut between 2014 and 16, it was the result of Saudi Arabia increasing production to drive down oil prices and hurt its competition among U.S. shale producers. They increased production by 1.2 million barrels a day and added over a half a billion barrels to global inventories. So if you take a look at what they were producing, 75% of the increase of their production made its way into inventory. Fast forward to where we were in 2018. Compare that to what happened last year, where 75% of Saudi Arabia's increase in production was absorbed by the world's oil market. Notice that, for example, when waivers were granted, OPEC immediately the following month cut production by 1.2 million barrels. There's just simply not much surplus out there, and it's going to be worked down very rapidly, I believe, during the first half of this year.
But still, Jim, what do you suppose accounts for this misperception where folks are saying there's a major glut versus actual oil market absorption of additional production? I mean, do you suppose it's the concept of peak demand coming from EVs, or do you think it's something else? Or maybe do you think it's a combination of a number of factors?
I think, it's a number of factors, but let's look at demand, which has been consistently understated and repeatedly revised by the IEA. Now, one reason why oil markets were kept tight in 2018 prior to the steep sell-off was that demand has been much stronger than estimated. The IEA, which is sort of the authoritative source in the oil industry, estimated a demand increase of roughly about 103 million barrels a day, for total daily consumption of 99.3 million barrels for last year. Then in November, they reported that demand was only 99.2 million barrels versus production of 99.9 million barrels. So this would imply a surplus daily that global inventories have grown by 240 million barrels throughout the year. That isn't what happened. The actual fact was that inventories only grew by 70 million barrels through November. And this has given way to the concept of what some analysts in the industry are called missing barrels. That's suggesting that demand is much greater than originally estimated. And this stands to reason. If we take a look at what has happened over the last decade, the IEA keeps revising their demand estimates. It's kind of like, Chris, when we get GDP figures for the quarter. The first estimate that comes out is they're relying on statistical evidence, and then you get a second estimate, and then you get a third estimate when you get the final numbers. And that's what happens with these oil demand estimates that come out with the IEA or by the EIA, which is the Energy Information Agency. They come out and they estimate, and then all of a sudden later on, as the data actually comes in, they go back and they revise them. But the oil markets paid little attention to the revisions. And so that's why it stands to reason, as the IEA keeps revising, let's say, their demand estimates after the fact almost every year. The point being made here is that demand is consistently understated. The other fact is that most oil trading takes place today with very little knowledge of fundamentals. It's based on, for example, algorithms than it does actual facts, which is one of the reasons why we got that steep sell-off of 40% in the final couple months of last year.
Well, this brings me to several reports out recently, and one is a report by Bank of America titled Oil Demand Growth to Hit Zero Within a Decade. Another report out of London reported in the Wall Street Journal that investment banks lowered their overall prices for oil this year from $69 to $67 on Brent and from $63 to $60 on WTI.
The Bank of America report is basing their assumption on the growing domination of electric vehicles in the next decade. And let's face it, demand for electric vehicles is increasing. You're seeing more and more car companies announcing that they're going to come out with a lot more models. I think there's like almost 250 new models that are expected to come out by the year 2025. And they estimate the current annual demand increase, which has been averaging roughly about 1.2 million barrels per day each year. That demand will drop from 1.2 million barrels. It'll drop in half to roughly 600,000 barrels of new demand by the year 2024. And then Bank of America says it drops to zero by 2030. Now, they cite the main driver of the steep drop-off is going to be the proliferation of electric vehicles. They project EV sales will grow to 5% of the auto market by 2020, to 40% of the market by 2030, and 95% by 2050. So, you know, close to 50 years from now or 40 years from now, we're going to all be driving around in electric cars. So, therefore, demand eventually begins to fade for oil as a transportation fuel. Could that happen? Well, maybe, but it's unlikely.
Jim, why do you feel that's the case? Because the EV sales growth of 5%, obviously going from 5% in 2020 to 95% by 2050, that's a huge projection. How do you feel that's the case?
Well, I mean, just take a look at where, you know, let's talk about electric vehicles. Where are they going to get that power from? They're going to get it from charging stations, which are electricity. And unfortunately, when it comes to power plants, there is no plug-and-play solution as to how our power plants are powered. I'm thinking of coal, oil, natural gas, hydro, and nuclear. Secondly, one-third of the world's population lives in China and India. And if you take a look at present population trends, that suggests they will continue to burn fossil fuels, even though China is making great strides with EVs and will become the dominant force in electric vehicles globally. Now, however, when you take a look at transportation, it's just not you and I driving around in cars. It's aviation and shipping, which will continue to burn oil. I just, you know, Chris, I don't see major transport ships going to nuclear power like our military submarines or aircraft carriers. Or for that matter, can you imagine a 787 Dreamliner flying on batteries anytime soon? I just don't think so. And now here's another issue that we also have to think about. 62% of the world's supply of cobalt output is found in the unstable Democratic Republic of Congo. I can't see any automaker betting their entire future on one unstable country with a virtual monopoly on an energy source. In addition, are there enough sufficient supplies of cobalt to replace fossil fuels? And finally, let me address this one, the affordability of electric vehicles. I mean, if you take a look at who owns, buys them, they're mainly Larry Lots of Bucks, Hollywood celebrities, rock stars, hedge fund managers, and the investment bankers of the world. Now, let's take a look at an inexpensive EV flopped with GM dropping its Chevy Volt. It's going to reintroduce a new electric vehicle, but it's going to be in its upper-end Cadillac line. And if you take a look at one of the leaders in EVs, Tesla, the Model 3, which is their cheapest vehicle, by the way, they just recently reduced the price to $43,000. And if you look at their popular S line, well, that starts out at roughly $80,000 for the basic model and can run up to over $100,000 for the performance version. EVs, and the other factor too, is EVs have less energetics than the internal combustion engine. They're a lot more expensive to own and drive. They tend to be owned by, let's say, the Larry Lots of Bucks of this world rather than the Larry Lawnmowers.
So with everything you're saying about EVs, Jim, it doesn't sound like a glowing review. Would you consider yourself negative on EVs?
Actually, no. I mean, I recently owned a hybrid, which I think is more practical. Eventually, I may own an EV, but I would not want to take a road trip in one and wait 45 minutes to get a charge instead of a five-minute gasoline fill-up. And also, the other thing we have to look at, we're eventually getting there, and I'll talk about that in a second here, but the transportation infrastructure isn't in place yet. It's interesting, though, there was a recent story this week done in the Journal and a couple other publications. Big Oil, you're thinking Exxon, Chevron, Royal Dutch, they're going on a buying spree by buying up electric car charging startups. So don't be surprised, Chris, in the not-too-distant future when you pull into your local Exxon station, you'll also have a car charging platform there as well. So right now, U.S. investments in charging infrastructure is running around $18 billion a year. So the country is gradually moving towards an EV transportation system, but it is going to be due more, I would say, to enhance, not take away from the internal combustion engine. So until the cost of EVs need to be made more affordable. And one problem is that China currently produces about two-thirds of the world's global supply of lithium batteries, which make up roughly about 40% of the cost of an entire vehicle. However, the fact that big oil is investing heavily acquiring charging stations tell you that EVs are increasing their share of the transportation market in cars. But their role in replacing demand for oil, in my opinion, is grossly misplaced. Now, the real issue right now, and this is one we should be talking about more because I think this is what lies ahead of us, is demand is still growing and investment in oil is lagging outside of U.S. shale. And that's a possible problem that could lead to higher prices in the next decade, a point Dr. Barol made in his recent Bloomberg interview.
There is a growing uncertainty and volatility in the oil markets. This makes the investors hesitating before putting their money for the new projects. For me, the greatest risk today we are facing is the investment appetite is very, very low. We cannot look at only today. We have to think a few years ahead in front of us. And what I see is that certainly there is a strong demand growth, but the unknown is where will the supply come from? U.S. shale will grow strongly, but U.S. shale to expect to grow more than 10 million barrels per day, bring the markets above one single Russia is a tall order. It can happen, but it will be a small miracle for me. Therefore, the biggest unknown is whether or not the conventional, the investment for the conventional projects will come or not.
He makes a good point. Where will the supply come from? Given those facts just discussed, I mean, are you still bullish on oil? And also, what about investments in energy?
You know, Chris, I remain bullish on the sector and still believe oil prices are heading higher and that we may be entering into a new bull market in commodities in the next decade. That's our sort of 40,000-foot view of the macro scene over the next decade. The thing that amazes me is how cheap and undervalued the energy sector remains. I mean, last year, the last couple of years, it was all about the FANG stocks. But if you look at fourth quarter earnings coming in from the big oil majors, they posted some of their best earnings, reporting profits at their highest levels since 2014 when oil was over $100 a barrel. Now, it doesn't matter where you look for earnings. They've exploded at the big five majors. Exxon booked Q4 profits of $6 billion, a third above analyst estimates. Cash flow for the year increased by over $30 billion, and that's the highest figure since 2014 when prices were much higher. You find similar results if you look at other companies in the big five, Chevron, Royal Dutch, British Petroleum. The top five, get this, are set to book a combined profit of $84 billion for the year, which is 13% above profits reported in 2014 when the price of oil was $100 a barrel. So it just shows that big oil has adjusted and can be extremely profitable even at much lower oil prices.
To sum it up, Jim, it sounds like you remain bullish on energy and energy equities. You believe oil prices are heading higher as a result of oil demand being understated, with the risk of lack of energy investment, which of course could lead to higher oil prices in the next decade. You also believe EVs will not replace gasoline demand and the demand and efficiency of the combustion engine.
That pretty much sums it up. I believe demand is greatly understated as well as the impact of shale oil. I mean, there simply is a dearth of conventional oil discoveries that will have an impact in the next decade. And that's why the IEA is concerned. I mean, we need to be spending trillions of dollars in regular conventional oil, not just shale, because as Dr. Barol just pointed, he said, we're going to have to discover the equivalent of another Saudi Arabia or Russia in the next decade. In other words, he's implying that U.S. shale production would have to go from 11 or 12 million where it is today to 20 to 22 million barrels a day. Is it possible? Maybe, but unlikely.
Well, okay, so given whether it's conventional oil or shale or whether it's Saudi Arabia or other geographical locations, where would you be investing?
You know, I still like big oil refiners and also some of the mid-tiered companies. The nice thing, and here's the great thing if you're an investor, and especially, you know, if you're relying on your investments for income, the energy sector is undervalued. It has high dividend yields ranging from, let's say, the low 3% level all the way up to 6%. So as an investor, you're being paid more than what you can earn on, let's say, bonds with the upside of annual increases in those dividends and in the better managed majors. I also believe we're on the cusp of a new commodities bull market that will reemerge in the next decade. But in the meantime, until perceptions change and the fundamentals kick in, the sector remains undervalued and underowned. So if you're looking for real value, energy is probably at the top of my list.
Coming up next, a new segment with Chris Poplava we call Smart Macro. We also will be answering some of the email that we've received from you.
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
We're going to begin a new segment here on The Big Picture. We are calling this Smart Macro as we take a look at some of the bigger issues around the globe in the markets. And joining me on the program for that is Chris Poplava. And Chris, you know, the market's been concerned about a lot of things. They've been looking at earnings, worries about a slowdown in growth globally. So from your perspective, some of the bigger picture items that you're looking at and what's on your radar screen?
Well, I think a lot of people are kind of looking at the current situation very similar to what happened in early 2016, where we had a slowdown that began in 2014. And that carried all the way through to early 2016. And we had a big change in heart from Janet Yellen. Back then, she was forecasting 4 rate hikes for the year. And she ended up only doing 1 at the very end of the year. But it was that big shift and pivot by Janet Yellen that a lot of people were kind of seeing as a market bottom. And then we did see a bottom in economic growth. A lot of the purchasing managers indexes from around the world were ticking up at that point. And that really was, in hindsight, a great buying opportunity. And I think some people are mistakenly looking at the December lows, very similar to that, where the market did sell off pretty significantly. And if you look at international markets, they sold off even more. And internationally, we've seen a deceleration in growth across the board, whether you're looking at Asia or Europe or even in Latin America. But in the U.S., we had pretty robust growth. But it looks like we're starting to see the U.S. growth beginning to cool a bit here. And it looks like we're recoupling with the rest of the world, somewhat similar to what we did in 2015 going into 2016. And then a lot of people are looking at the analogy of or comparison of Jerome Powell and what he's done last month with his big shift in policy to what Yellen did back in February of 2016, and looking at that as a market bottom very similar to what happened in 2016. I think that one of the missing ingredients of this time versus then, and why in hindsight the December lows may not be the ultimate low, or at least a lifting point for the market, is that the global economy is continuing to slow. And the real inflection point that we saw in early 16 did see an inflection point with global economic growth beginning to turn up. And we have yet to see that. In fact, if you look at the economic data coming from abroad, we're seeing further deceleration. One of the things that we created was a economic diffusion index of looking at growth from across the world, looking at 38 countries, and some of those developed, some of those emerging market. And as of right now, we're seeing a real downturn in terms of the number of countries showing positive economic growth. And another thing we look at is not only the level of growth, whether they're in positive territory or negative territory, but also the acceleration of that growth rate or percentage of those that are growing. And even that is still very, very low. We're not seeing an upturn yet, just like we did in 2016, or even the upturn we saw in 2010 when we had the initial cooling coming off of the global financial crisis. So I think it is a little bit early to kind of throw caution to the wind and make the comparison to the 2016 bottom. I think we still have a lot more digestion to go in terms of economic growth. And so I do not think that the risks are fully behind us.
One of the things that is a little bit different this time, too, is we had a great impetus from the tax cuts and then the additional spending programs that was authorized by Congress. I think the figure was $300 billion. Some of that is going to be played out by the time we get to September. But let me move on to something that may corroborate this, and that is what we've seen coming out of Q4 earnings. What has been really surprising is see how these earnings have slowed down tremendously. A lot of couples, you know, everybody remembers Apple coming out saying that they were going to miss their earnings estimates. But a lot of these companies have said, you know, going forward, it's not going to be looking as good. So what about corporate earnings? Because ultimately, that's what drives stock prices.
Well, I think that is a concern, especially with global growth, because a lot of, I think it's somewhere around 40% of revenue for S&P 500 companies comes from abroad. So if we continue to see slowing abroad, that's going to translate into earnings and revenue from abroad as well. And so if growth tends to undershoot to the downside over the coming months, well, then you're going to see earnings estimates being ratcheted down lower, and you're going to see more and more negative surprises in terms of earnings. For example, if you just look at Germany, we saw Germany manufacturing orders year over year came in at negative 7% for December. That was one of the lowest readings outside of 2010, and any readings lower than that, we'd be looking at the lowest level since the great financial crisis of 08-09. So when looking at Germany, there's really no signs of a slowdown, and Italy itself is in a technical recession. They've had two consecutive quarters of negative of GDP growth, which puts them in a recession, and that's very concerning, and that's one of the flashpoints that I'll be watching for this year, is that Italy is the third most indebted sovereign country in the world, and they've got over $2.2 trillion in outstanding debt. And this year alone is the biggest single year for all of the outstanding debt that Italy has in terms of its maturity schedule. I think it's something around the lines of $325 billion needs to be rolled over this year, which is roughly about 17% of their entire debt load. So that could not come at a potentially worse time, given that the ECB is done buying sovereign debt with ending QE in December. And I think that's a reason why when you look at Italian bond yields relative to German yields, that they remain elevated. They hit a low in 2018, but they're continuing to remain elevated from that level, even with the risk rally that we've seen over the past month. And just this week alone, they've begun to start to head higher, which is a concern and showing signs that Italy is displaying some stress in their debt markets.
2 points on that. Let's go back to Italy. They just issued 30-year bonds this week, and with an interest rate at 3.85%, it was well received, and there was a great demand for that debt. So it looks like in a world that has low yields, they can still find buyers.
It does, and I think that was really smart of them to do that. We had, again, a rally in the equity markets as well as bond markets over the last few months, particularly in Europe. And so for them to issue a 30-year debt offering at a time when interest rates in Italy had come down by 50 basis points was very smart on their part. But again, I think I would not be one of those investors buying their debt given their constrained balance sheet. And then if you look at their private banking sector, they're still showing a lot of stress there as well. For example, the Banca Monte, they've seen their market cap in euros fall from a high of 10 billion euros to a low of only 1 billion. So that's a bank in Italy that's seen 90% roughly of its market cap wiped out. And they're also showing continued buildup in stress when you look at their credit default swaps. They're remaining pretty elevated, not as high as it was in 2010, 2011 with the Greek financial crisis, but definitely doesn't show that the all clear sign there given how elevated they remain.
Recently, we've seen the global PMIs really start to soften. In many countries, they're below 50, indicating that the economy is contracting. If we look at recently, the PMIs for China, Germany, Italy, Turkey, South Korea, and Colombia are among those contracting in January. So if this was to be a similar situation to 2016, what would you look for to confirm that, well, maybe this is another hiccup, and we're now back to the road of recovery as we were in 2016 when Yellen pivoted?
I think you really need to see two things. A significant peak in the dollar, which I don't know. I know the Fed Powell has begun to pivot where he's not talking about as many rate hikes for this year, even talking about winding down quantitative tightening in which the Fed is decreasing its balance sheet. Would not be surprised at all if eventually the Fed does end its program of shrinking its balance sheet. But at the same time, if you look at the European Central Bank, they also are downgrading the outlook for their economy. And it's clear, as we've mentioned, looking at Italy and Germany, there's some definite problems there. And so they may have to push off their first rate hike. Back in 2018, I think the projections in the fourth quarter was that Italy, or at least the markets, were pricing in a rate hike as early as September of 2019. I think that's getting pushed off the table given their recent commentary. And even the Bank of Japan has kind of taken more of a dovish tone. So to get a real peak in the dollar, it'd be kind of difficult, even though we are seeing Powell move more towards the dovish side. If we see other central banks doing that as well, then it would be kind of hard to see a top in the dollar. It might be just status quo or currencies. If everyone's kind of moving more towards the dovish stance, that currencies more or less remain side or trade sideways for the time being. But I would want to see a top in the dollar. I think that would be a huge benefit to the global economy, particularly when you see the risk assets that tend to show greater stress with a strong dollar. And I would also want to see global growth begin to stabilize. And one of the key engines of that would be China, which continues to show economic deceleration. So I think you'd really want to see China begin to stabilize, which would then reverberate throughout the entire global economy. And from there, once we see stabilization, that would be a much better picture or sign that the all clear would have given.
Final issue, a particular point that we've been bringing up here on the program is the liquidity in the bond markets, and it shrunk. Part of that coming with Dodd-Frank in 2008 or 2009, that is, when they required banks to basically shrink their trading activities. That's shrunk dealer inventories to a fraction of what it is. And what was rather interesting is, Chris, this week Fitch, the credit rating service, issued a report on liquidity coming from bond ETFs and bond mutual funds. They may be sitting on a lot of the debt, whether it's triple B rated or junk bond rated. That is a lot of debt that is not very liquid. You know, ultimately, I guess if you drop the price down strong enough, a situation we saw in 2016, where we were able to pick up some great bonds. What about the Fitch warning that came out this week? Have you ever seen anything like that in the bond market?
We were seeing signs of that late in the fourth quarter. I believe in December, we didn't see any junk bond new issue debt issued in the U.S., which was very atypical. And I think that was just showing a real outright decline in appetite for risk assets. And so watching the credit default swaps on junk debt as well as investment grade debt, watching spreads between corporate debt and U.S. Treasuries, I think that would really help to indicate signs of stress in the corporate debt market. One of the things that is a concern that came out this Monday was a Fed senior loan survey. And we did see commercial banks were tightening lending standards, not just on commercial industrial loans, but also to the consumer and also in terms of real estate loans. So we are seeing a general tightening in lending standards by commercial banks, and they were also reporting weaker loan demand. And it's their expectation that we should see, or they believe they're going to see, a slight pickup in default rates later this year. So there are some clear signs that the flow of liquidity is beginning to dry up in the economy and the markets, and that does bear watching, particularly in the U.S. corporate debt markets, given how leveraged U.S. corporations are from where they were 10 years ago.
So if we were to sum up, Chris, a couple things that we're seeing a slowdown in global growth that's reflected clearly in a lot of the major PMIs around the globe, whether it's China or elsewhere. And then we're also seeing a slowdown in corporate earnings, a lot of companies missing their estimates, and then also warning about the quarters ahead. This is a topic that we're going to be covering here every single week, a segment that we call Smart Macro, as we take a look at some of the events, whether they're economic or financial, in the markets or globally, that affect the markets and your investments. Chris, if people want to follow your work, how could they do so?
They can give us a call at 858-487-3939, or they can read our articles on the web at financialsense.com.
All right, Chris, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, thanks for having me.
On this part of the Big Picture, we're going to be answering email from you, our listeners. And Jim, The first email we have, the listener wants to know, who is buying U.S. debt now that China, Japan, and even the Fed are slowing their purchases? And the listener also wants to know, if buyers are stepping back as it seems, why aren't U.S. interest rates shooting up?
You know, that's an interesting question. And what we've seen over the last year, China is holding roughly about half the amount of debt that they used to. But what has happened is, and especially during the fourth quarter of last year when we saw a lot of volatility in the stock market, we went from records to actually losses for the year. Well, there are institutions out there like insurance companies, pension funds that have to hold securities. And by the way, you, the individual investors stepped up their holdings of treasuries in the fourth quarter of last year by quite a substantial amount of money. So in answer to your question, who is buying it? It's U.S. investors, from individual investors all the way to institutions like pensions and also insurance companies. So there's still a great demand. And if you take a look at globally, whenever there's any kind of trouble surfacing around the globe, the safe haven has always been the dollar and the U.S. Treasury market, the most liquid and largest bond market in the world. So that's where the demand is coming from.
And our next email comes from Douglas, who says, I answered a telephone call at work a few weeks ago and agreed to a financial planning discussion just to find out what the group had in mind. I thought it was employer-sponsored, but now I'm not so sure. I turned 59 last October, thought I had plenty of time left to continue investing via my 401k. At the end of the meeting, they asked for another, which is scheduled for about 2 weeks. They said there are things that can be done at age 59 and a half to improve my opportunities. Would your team like to comment on that? I'm a bit skeptical because after years of listening to your program, I've never heard reference to such business unless I just missed it. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention it in case you might want to offer some advice.
Well, in fact, if you listen to Lifetime Income, I think it was part three, we did a whole segment on important dates in saving for retirement, and it just so happens age 59 and a half happens to be one of them. What they're referring to, a 401k plan or IRAs, normally if you take money from a 401k or an IRA, they're in addition to paying taxable, including that as taxable income where you pay federal and state taxes, there was also a 10% penalty for early withdrawal. What disappears at age 59 and a half is that 10% penalty no longer applies. Now, in terms of 401k, there's another rule that goes into effect, and that's age 55. It's at age 55, an employee who is either laid off, fired, or quits a job between the ages of 55 and 59 and a half, you can pull money out of an IRA or 401k, 403b plan without paying that 10% penalty. The other thing that may happen is some employers, when you're getting close to retirement, let's say, I don't know, you've got a big chunk of money in your 401k plan, you feel like you would have better options if you could control it yourself in your own IRA. Some companies, you'll have to check with your HR, will allow you to roll over your 401k plan and roll that over into an IRA while still contributing to your existing 401k plan. So those are basically the things they're probably talking about. Age 59 and a half, withdrawing without a penalty. Age 55, you can also withdraw without penalty if you quit, lose a job, or get fired.
And for our listeners, when Jim referred to part three, that's our February 4th podcast titled It's Not About a Number, It's About You, part three. And Jim, our next listener asks, years ago when I took economic classes in college, there was a discussion about how the Fed impacted the money supply by increasing or decreasing reserve requirements for member banks. Higher requirements reduced the money supply, lower requirements increased the money supply. They also could increase or decrease the rate they charged banks for excess reserves on deposit at the Fed. My question is, how did we get from the Fed charging interest on excess reserves to paying them, and what was the logic behind that change?
Well, if you take a look at the way the financial system works, depository institutions, that includes banks, savings, credit unions, they must meet what is called statutory reserve requirements. The amount a bank must hold in reserves is based on its deposit liabilities. Now, banks can either keep cash in their vaults or hold deposits with the Fed. Most banks today have accounts with their regional Federal Reserve Bank, not only to satisfy these reserve requirements, but also for the payment services the Fed offers. Now, what happened? Reserve banks didn't used to be able to pay interest on deposits. That changed with the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. And the reason that went into play, in order to provide more liquidity in the banking system, the Fed really needed to expand its balance sheet by buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. They were trying to stabilize the system, recapitalize the banking system, and create liquidity. Now, the only way they could do that was to expand their reserve deposits the banks held with the Fed. So basically, it was necessary to pay interest on those deposits in order to avoid excessive money growth solely as a result of the temporary injection of liquidity, which, by the way, went on with QE for quite some time. Now, depository institutions receive interest on the minimum required reserve balances that they hold at the Fed. Now, the Fed isn't a place where banks can park their money. Now, what will happen? So as you take a look at what the Fed is doing, it's been raising interest rates. What does that mean? The interest it also pays the banks are also rising. But as the Fed begins to shrink its balance sheet, the amount of interest the Fed pays out should decline.
And Jim, there's a follow-up question that asks, related to this question, is the legality of this type of change and who makes it? I assume it's the Fed's board. And since I'm extremely cynical of the Fed in the first place, I think they probably did so to benefit their shareholders, the big banks.
Well, actually, in this case, it was the U.S. Congress, and they did that with the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008, which basically gave the reserve banks the power to pay interest on reserves.
Well, thank you, Jim, for answering those questions. And we do want to thank you, our listeners, for submitting those questions. Now, if you have a question that you would like answered on the podcast, you can do so by going to financialsense.com. And toward the top of the page, just click where it says Contact Us. And we'll be happy to answer your question. Now, Jim, with everything that we've talked about today, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
Coming up in the weeks ahead, we're still a little bit into the corporate earnings season. In the month of March, we're going to have the debt ceiling debate. Yes, folks, we're going to be approaching $22 trillion of debt. And of course, another FOMC meeting in March, which nobody expects things to change. But right now, I would say it is going to be on the political front. Will they work out a budget deal? And will we have another shutdown when it comes down to negotiating an extension of U.S. debt? All that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here in the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.